Good morning. It's KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Coming up next at 9 o'clock, the topic is the human rights of immigrants at the U.S.-Mexico border. Then at 9:30, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 10 o'clock, we'll hear a program on the Virgen de Guadalupe, which is celebrated throughout Mexico. And at 10:30, Art Focus with Julie Bernard. Her guest today is Ashley Rowland of the dance company Body Vox. They'll discuss costumes. And then at 11 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! It's the 25th anniversary of the assassination of John Lennon. We'll acknowledge that, and we'll hear about torture flights and secret prisons coming up on Democracy Now! At 11.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for the Radio Zine. I'm speaking with Christian Ramirez. He is the AFSC, American Friends Service Committee, U.S.-Mexico Border Program Director, visiting Portland from San Diego. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you talk about what your job is as the Program Director for this part of AFSC?
Well, we've been tracking human rights abuses along the border since 1977 in San Diego. We focus primarily on monitoring U.S. policies around enforcement of the border and also immigration policies and the impact that those immigration policies have on human rights for not only migrants but also border residents. So since 1977, we've been tracking this the impact of enforcement, and most recently, about 3 or 4 years ago, we began to an organizing campaign to organize vulnerable communities, migrant communities in San Diego, on how to promote their rights, how to become civic participants in order to change the policies that impact their communities. And most recently, earlier this year, we formed an alliance with human rights organizations in Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas in an effort to bring the voices from the border to Washington and to the general public in the U.S. to tell them about the impact that enforcement policies have had on border communities for many, many decades now.
Could you talk a little bit about just generally what you've seen in or what you know of in the years that the program has been in existence about the general flow of people and what's happening to them?
Well, about 10 years ago, or to be more exact, in 1994, the Clinton administration launched Operation Gatekeeper. Operation Gatekeeper's intent was to seal off the urban areas between Tijuana and San Diego, the border region, in an effort to push the migrant flows away from the urban areas and into the rural and inhospitable areas of the Southwest, the deserts and the mountains of the Southwest of the California, the California deserts. That first year, we began to notice a huge impact on the immigration flows. Folks began to die in high numbers in the deserts, initially in the mountains and soon thereafter in the deserts. And we began to notice that a very profound impact on migrant flows. We began to notice how migrants were now risking their lives, really, attempting to cross into the United States, and many of them died attempting to do so. Soon thereafter, Operation Safeguard was launched in Arizona in an effort, again, to push migrant flows away from the urban areas and channel those migrant flows into the deserts of Arizona. The same was done in the eastern part of the border, in the Ciudad Juarez-El Paso border region. It was known as Operation Hold the Line. And in South Texas, in the Brownsville area, as Operation Rio Grande. So these four operations funneled the migration flows into the deserts with a deadly result.
Because
migrants are now coming across through the deserts. Instead of coming through the urban areas, instead of coming through the ports of entry, these are undocumented migrants with no way of entering the country regularly. They are not coming through the deserts. And this has created a human rights nightmare. 3,600 people have lost their lives attempting to cross the U.S.-Mexico border since 1994. And I have to add that in 1994, the North American Free Trade Agreement was launched. NAFTA allowed for the goods and money to come across the border with no difficulties, but made it very, very difficult, made it deadly for a migrant worker to come across the border. And since NAFTA was launched, there has not been an opportunity to create an immigration package, immigration reforms that allows the easy and safe movement of people. Mm-hmm. This has had a devastating situation that led to the crisis that we are facing or that 2005 presented along this border. 2005 has been by far the most deadly, the deadliest and most violent year in the history of the U.S.-Mexico border.
Why 2005? Why do you think it's peaked so much then?
Well, we've began to see a an increase of or violent response being mainstreamed, being justified, a violent response to the immigration debate. In April of 2005, the Minuteman Project made its appearance, known in Arizona. The Minuteman Project is a paramilitary movement, a vigilante group that have always existed along the U.S.-Mexico border. They're definitely nothing new to the border landscape. But in 2005, in April, they were really good at capturing the attention of the mainstream media and of the general public in the United States with a message of protecting the U.S. borders from a terrorist attack, with a message of saying that they are patriots, that they are protecting the United States. They were able to capture the attention of the media. And in doing so, they were able to mainstream hate. They were able to say that carrying guns and going to the border and hunt people down was a justified response to the immigration debate. And soon thereafter, we began to notice how not only vigilante groups who have always been on the fringes of society were speaking this kind of message, but also elected officials. Governor Schwarzenegger, for instance, invited the Minutemen group to come to California. The governors of Arizona, Texas, and New Mexico, Democrats and Republicans alike, declare states of emergencies in the border states. We began to notice how elected officials at the federal level began to propose initiatives such as creating a 2,000-mile fence, such as deporting migrants from throughout the United States, such as creating a climate of xenophobia in the United States against migrant communities. So not only do we have the presence of vigilante groups along the border, but 2005 marked the deadliest year for migrants. 460 people lost their lives this year attempting to cross the border at the end of the fiscal year, which ended in October of this year. 460 people died coming across the border, the deadliest year in the history of the border. So 2005 will go down as one of the most violent years on this border, and the debate is not over. In the next couple of days, before the year closes, Congress, or at least the House, will pass a resolution, most likely will pass a resolution in which a 2,000-mile fence will be approved by the lower house of the U.S. Congress, making the situation at the border perhaps even more violent. And 2006 will probably be a very busy year around the issue of immigration, and the debate will continue in Congress and in the White House now that President Bush has added to the debate of immigration.
In talking about this year as the deadliest year and those 400 and some deaths, the deaths are caused by desert conditions, or generally what causes the people that have died to die?
Most of the deaths are attributed to climatic conditions. Many migrants cross through the most dangerous terrains in the hemisphere, in which in the summer months, the scorching temperatures of the Arizona desert are impossible for a human being to survive, much less a human being that's attempting to cross and walking for 3 or 4 days with no water, with no shade. It's a very, very difficult journey, and most migrants have died as a result of that. And because many migrants are crossing now through more isolated areas, we estimate the number of deaths is probably higher. 460 is the official number by the U.S. Border Patrol. And these are actually bodies that are found. The bodies that are not counted are the bodies of those that die, for instance, in sealed train containers of migrants who cross through the in trains in the wagons of the trains and are sealed and die in their attempt to cross into the United States. So unfortunately, many of the deaths are caused because of climatic conditions. And this is kind of the most troubling piece of this debate, because after all, these folks are coming across the border to work. And how many of us will cross through a mountain or through a desert for 3 or 4 days to find a job? And I think that that's the debate, the piece of the debate that's missing. The human drama that thousands upon thousands of people are experiencing. And to make matters even worse, 2005 also marked the passage of the Central American Free Trade Agreement by the Congress of the United States, which will, without a doubt, create an increased flow of migrants from Central America coming across Mexico as a bridge to enter into the United States. So we estimate that as the debate over immigration intensifies in the United States, and as free trade agreements are passed with Central America and other Latin American nations, that this is a recipe for disaster. Migrants will be pushed from their communities, from the sending nations, from Latin American nations, to come into the United States and find themselves with a border much more difficult to cross. But that in essence, the border will continue to be porous because we still need migrant workers in this country. And that's the biggest hypocrisy of this debate. That on the one hand, many elected officials are saying control the borders. But on the other hand, they're proposing economic policies that create the conditions in Latin American nations for people to leave their nation, their countries, and enter into the United States. So this hypocritical situation is creating a huge problem in terms of human rights along the U.S.-Mexico border.
Let's talk a little bit about the Minutemen that you mentioned, and I know you have some involvement in a film that was made regarding that whole movement. Tell us about who these people are, how they get involved in this kind of thing, and how long they last, that kind of thing.
Well, vigilantism is nothing new to the U.S.-Mexico border. It's been around ever since the border has been around. The Border Patrol, for instance, began as a consolidation of many of these vigilante groups. The Texas Rangers, for instance, were paid by the number of Mexicans that were lynched. And there was a point between 1846 and 1848 that more Mexicans were lynched in the Southwest than African Americans were lynched in the South. So the history of lynchings and of vigilantism goes back many, many years along the U.S.-Mexico border. But most recently, this phenomenon of paramilitary activity has been known as the Minutemen Project. And the most troubling part of the Minutemen Project is not so much their violent rhetoric, because it's really nothing new to us. It's always been there. But the fact that they were able to penetrate into the mainstream media, the fact that they were able to recruit a lot of new volunteers into their movement, and although they were able to enjoy a lot of coverage in television, really their numbers don't reflect the coverage that they obtained in the media. They still are a small force. Many border residents did not join their efforts. Many of those folks that are coming to the border are not border residents. They don't come from the border. They come from elsewhere. And these are groups that have been, again, around for a long time and that have close links to neo-Nazi groups, for instance, white power organizations, hate groups that have been around the United States for many years, unfortunately. It's a way to say that violence is a justified response to a very critical social debate, which is the issue of immigration. The problem is not the presence of them or their actions, because they have been around for many years, and by and large, we have pushed them to the fringes of our society. But the trouble comes when elected officials begin to promote the same rhetoric, and we begin to justify violence as a response to a social problem. And this is when the cycle of violence begins, and it could go down into a downward spiral. I think the images of Paris are still very much present in our minds, to, you know, what happened this year in Paris, in which migrant communities revolted and there was rioting in Paris and other cities in France as a result of racist and xenophobic policies passed by the French government, the rebirth of neo-Nazi groups in Western Europe. So this is something that could happen in the U.S., and this is where we as the American Friends Service Committee get involved in ensuring that we break the cycle of violence. That, yes, we responded to the fact that the Minutemen Project that was active and continues to be active in many places along the border, and we are hearing reports now that there are similar groups like that here in the state of Oregon, that we tell them that we have to have a debate around the issue of immigration, but the debate must not be violent. And elected officials in this nation need to be responsible. They need to make sure that they tone down the rhetoric, that this is not an issue of crime or terrorism. This is an issue of economics, and that you cannot treat workers in this fashion. To do that is to create a climate of violence that will fall into a never-ending cycle of conflict and violence around the issue of immigration.
How about with someone like Schwarzenegger, who made those statements that you referred to, praising the actions of the Minutemen? Do you think there was a backlash against what he said? Do you think he also brought on some criticism of that attitude too?
Yes, you know, I think California has had a long debate around this issue. About 10 years ago, in the same year in which Operation Gatekeeper was launched, Prop 187 was used by former or then governor Pete Wilson, also Republican, also a governor that faced a very huge deficit in California, and a governor that was quick to wave the flag of the scapegoat and placing blame on the most vulnerable, which are migrants. And that issue of Prop 187 divided Californians, and it was a very tense time. Governor Schwarzenegger tried to revive that. And I think to one degree or another, he was successful in reviving the anti-immigrant hysteria in California and creating a situation in which California was becoming now and again a hotbed for vigilantes in that state. And that was a reprehensible act. But I think that there was a lot of folks in California who said, wait a minute, you know, we cannot allow this kind of individuals to come to our state and to promote violence. And I think that that Governor Schwarzenegger's comments around the issue of vigilantism really put him in a difficult situation. Now he's backpedaling. Now he's trying to apologize for what he has said. But I think that it will remain to be seen in next year's elections. He'll be up for re-election next year to see what happens with him. But Governor Schwarzenegger's not alone. There are other governors. There are other Congress members. There are other elected officials who have been promoting the same kind of rhetoric that Governor Schwarzenegger has been promoting. I think that it is time for us as civil society to begin to contribute to this debate, to begin to really realize that the fact is that we need workers, that we need migrant workers, that we've always needed them, that folks have come and worked in the agricultural fields up and down the Pacific Coast for many generations. It's not a new phenomena. And that we have to be responsible, and we have to be a mature civil society, and we have to hold elected officials accountable. Anyone, no matter if you're an elected official or not, that praises vigilantism, that invites vigilantism, which in essence is they're outside of the law, they have to be held accountable. And as a democratic society, we have to say that we cannot allow vigilante expressions to exist in order to have a debate. You cannot have a sensible debate, a democratic debate, if you have weapons involved. And it's just a sad statement that in 21st century America, there are still those that believe that with weapons alone, you are going to change or intimidate people into a debate. And that's something that should be reprehensible to all of us, no matter where you stand on the issue of immigration.
I'm speaking with Christian Ramirez. He is the AFSC U.S.-Mexico Border Program Director. You started to get into it there, Christian, but what do you think needs to happen regarding the Minutemen and then immigration policy issues? What would be your best case scenario for what would promote human rights and allow a fair situation for people?
Well, first, folks that come into the border with weapons, they need to be held accountable. We have gotten reports of vigilantes holding people at gunpoint, kidnappings, impersonation of federal agents, and not only holding undocumented people, but holding U.S. citizens as well, border residents. We have a huge problem along the border. We live in a state of siege, and it's a virtual war zone for us. I was born and raised in the border, and you grew up thinking that fences and border patrol helicopters flying overhead and being stopped and being handcuffed is a normal occurrence. Not until you travel to other places and you realize that you don't live in the United States. You live in some place in which your rights have been suspended. And that's something that folks in the United States need to know. There are 8 million people that live on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border, and our rights need to be protected. So that's the first step. Demilitarize the border. Do not have a military-style response to a very serious problem, which is the problem of immigration, but having military-type tactics only undermines our Constitution, undermines democratic principles. The next step is to look at our trade policies. We have been trading with Mexico for over 11 years. Tariffs and other taxes that made trade with Mexico difficult before NAFTA was introduced have long disappeared. Now you could go to any place in Mexico and enjoy a Big Mac and shop at Walmart. And you could go any place in New York City or Chicago or anywhere else in the United States and enjoy Mexican products. And this is the biggest contradiction here. We have people who are crossing the border with no difficulties. Transnationals that are crossing the border with no difficulties. But human beings are not allowed to do the same. Let us have an immigration package that is sensible, that allows people to come and cross through the ports of entries. Because just as money, just as capital, just as products are allowed to do so, let us have a package that allows migrant workers to come and work in the apple industry in Washington State, that works in the fertile valleys of California. These people have been coming across the border for many years. They will not stop coming because we need them. Let us have a sensible package that recognizes the contribution of migrants, and let's stop treating migrants as criminals. If we decriminalize the immigration phenomena, if we stop lumping the issue of immigration with terrorism and crime and drug trafficking, we begin to invest our resources really in trying to stop the issues of terrorism and crime. I think that all of us agree that there are issues around criminality and drug trafficking and what have you, but immigrants are not part of that problem. We're asking for human beings to be given the same treatment that we have given to television sets or to Big Macs. And that's something that we're asking. That's the only thing that we're asking.
And are you appealing to local and state governments there at the border, to federal officials and policymakers, or how would that all work?
Well, we, as a matter of fact, we'll be traveling to Washington, D.C. in the next couple of weeks before the end of the year to monitor closely a bill that's pending in the House that's going to be voted on the floor of the House the next week, actually. And we'll be monitoring that very, very closely. We're also urging local officials to pass resolutions in favor of human rights, that as this debate gets more and more intense, and as we have now said it's okay to bring guns into the debate of immigration, let us have sensible discussions locally. Let us have a sensible discussion here in Portland, in Seattle, in San Diego, and elsewhere about the issue of immigration. Let us look to immigrants as not our enemy, but let us bring those bridges of communications that have been missing for many years. I was just walking earlier today in the streets of Portland, and I saw a group of people not too far from this radio station looking for jobs. I spoke to some of them, and it's just amazing how many of these folks were being picked up to go work. I'm imagining as gardening or construction. And we don't have that debate. We still treat these workers who are standing in the corner as disposable commodities. Let us have a debate about this issue. Let us really have a serious debate and see how can we contribute to making this issue better. Ultimately, from the government, we don't expect a whole lot. We have asked them to change laws. We have asked them to look at the issues of human rights, and all we've gotten is fencing. All we've gotten is additional Border Patrol agents. All we've gotten now are Minutemen. I think it's time for us as civil society to look at the issue of immigration, and for us to not look the other way. And let us realize that we need migrant workers in this country, that we hired them. So I think that, to me, it was really not shocking. I would say it wasn't shocking. It was as though the issue of immigration is everywhere, but we want to ignore it. It was refreshing for me to see day laborers in Portland. I knew that there was an issue here with day laborers, but I was just walking in, I don't know the city a whole lot. I was walking earlier today, and I saw this debate in front of us. But all of us participate on this issue, but none of us want to engage in the debate. And I think it's about time that we engage in this debate, and we tell our elected officials how we should feel and how we should address the issue of immigration.
So the individual listening to this, or the individual in our society, should, it sounds like, start thinking about this question more seriously, thinking about all the things that you've been talking about, the human rights involved, the hypocrisy involved, and it sounds like take an active role themselves in at least contacting government officials about how they vote on things and such.
That's exactly what we're urging folks to do. Contact your elected official. Have the sense to put yourself in the position of that migrant worker who crossed through a desert, who is now in the United States without the possibility of driving a car because he can't get a driver's license, without the possibility of sending his children to school, to the university because they can't afford it, without the possibility of having a dignified housing, and still in 21st century America, having to stand in a corner waiting to be picked up by a U.S. citizen to work. Let us have it, you know, we can't have it both ways. Let's have a sensible discussion. Let's encourage our elected officials to be responsible, to tone down the rhetoric, to not continue to promote vigilante-type activities along the border, and to really prove to the world that we can have a sensible debate around the issue of immigration. If we don't do that, we will continue to create conditions like the ones that are being generated in Western Europe, in which neo-Nazi groups are now reappearing, in which people are being massively deported. Let us hope that we could send an example to the world, and that we as a civil society, we as a democratic nation, can really have a debate that really tones down the use of violence in response to a very complicated, very, very complex debate. It's not an easy debate at all. It's quite complicated. There are many issues to and many perspectives to this story. But I think all of us have to agree on one thing, that using guns to intimidate folks, to detain folks, is not a viable solution. That's not the way to approach it. Let us hope that we still have dialogue as the best way to have a very serious and much overdue debate around immigration.
One more thing in the last minute or so of this interview. I know that we'll be hearing this interview on KABU when a showing of the movie is over, but the movie that has been made is called
Rights on the Line, Vigilantes on the Border. It's a co-production between the American Friends Service Committee, the ACLU, and Witness, which is a filmmaking nonprofit organization based out of New York City. And it will be available here at the American Friends Service Committee office in Portland. Feel free to visit our website, www.afsc.org, for more information on the video. It will be screened here in Portland, and hopefully we'll have several screenings throughout the Northwest in the next couple of weeks.
I want to thank you very much for stopping by KABU while you're in Portland and wish you the best in your work. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Christian Ramirez, AFC U.S.-Mexico Border Program Director. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KABU.
Me treat you the way that I do. Gee, baby, ain't I good to you? There's nothing in this world too good for a girl so good and true. Gee, baby, ain't I good to you? Bought you a fur coat for Christmas, a diamond ring, a big Cadillac car, and everything. What makes me treat you the way that I do? Gee, baby, ain't I good to you?
Well, as you can hear, I've just arrived in my horse-drawn jingling sled. It's a special global warming sled. Had to replace the rails with wheels. This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO, in Cascadia, KBOO Portland. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members. Yay! Long may they wave. And a grant from Portland's gay and lesbian community Yellow Pages. How appropriate. Providing a wide array of gay-friendly business listings. More information at 503-230-7701 or on the web at www.pdxgayyellowpages.com. There, now I get to sign the little thing that says, I said this at 9:30 a.m. I'm going to do it right here on the air. There. Okay. I've heard that the White House is now direct. Oh, hi. I'm Teresa Mitchell. And I don't sound like a Teresa because I lived as a guy for 41 years. Let's see, was it longer than that? Maybe it was 43 years. Yeah. And I'm trans. And this is the only trans program that I know of that's on regularly, which just kind of tells you the sort of free speech you can get on community radio. I've heard that the White House is now directing its staff to answer the phone with a Merry Christmas. With, you know, and if you're Jewish or any other religion, well, heck with you. You know, they're not going to say Eid Mubarak, and they're not going to say Happy Hanukkah. They're going to say Merry Christmas with presidential approval ratings in the 30s. No doubt the spinmeisters desire to consolidate the anti-intellectual fundamentalist base by placating their desire for religious hegemony. Meanwhile, the Democrats continue their losing strategy of attempting to placate the Republicans as Hillary Clinton co-sponsors an anti-flag-burning bill. Gee, that's important, don't you think? I mean, gosh, I could hardly get to the station this morning for all those flag burners. It's dangerous, you know, just flaming bits of flag. What if it got in the gas tank? Gosh. I'm just glad that Hillary's on top of it. You know, I don't like Christianity. I see it as an effective means of cultural and mind control. Obviously, it's working for George Bush's pitifully loyal minority base. There are plenty of Christians I like just fine, of course, as well as members of other religions. Religion is, of course, a personal affair and not an appropriate venue for personal contention. But it is also a political subject. George Bush's type had made it that way. And so I'm going to talk about it. I don't like the Abrahamic religions generally, mostly for their rabid sexism. They also tend to be chauvinist and exclusionist, and I find those qualities infantile. Those qualities, however, are perfect for limiting the thinking of a population, for keeping the people at each other's throats. In the U.S., for the followers of Bushism, this infantilism reaches an extreme. I don't see the point of blind faith. I realize that life and death can be terrifying, and I intend to keep it that way. There's no need to pretend that I can guarantee knowledge of my consciousness and personality once this body dies, nor do I think that I can curry the favor of a god by mindlessly repeating arbitrarily recorded scriptures. Matter of fact, I just don't think I can curry the favor of a god. I do respect research by open-minded, well-educated, curious people. Thus, I read in Barbara Walker's cultural research, for example, that the Christmas tree does not come from Christianity. The tree was at time not cut, but venerated, decorated by Celts and other Europeans as an attractant for the spirits of ancestors, or sometimes called the fairies. There was a time and a place when it was considered thoughtful to ornament the tree, uncut, standing out there in the forest where you would party down, and you would ornament it with the heads of defeated enemies. In the 19th century, this pagan tradition evolved into the Tannenbaum, in which the tree was brought inside to celebrate Christianity. December 25th is a day in which the sun in the northern hemisphere may be seen to spend more time spreading daylight. Due to planetary momentum, this phenomenon is not as obvious immediately after the solstice, which precedes Christmas by a few days. The body responds to the spreading light on the 25th with a feeling of hope, which is why December 25th was Mithra's birthday. He was called the sun god or the bull. He was born on that day, according to that religion, 300 years before Christ. Those who believed in Mithra were to have everlasting life. He was born under humble circumstances in a cave, but he was visited by three Persian adept astrologer mystics called the Magi. Now ask yourself, What are those Persians doing visiting a Hebrew? December 25th is also the Sol Invictus Day, the day of the unconquered sun. Great feasting and sex parties were held that day, the Saturnalia, honoring Saturn as well as the others. In Europe, as the Holy Roman Emperor, or the Pope, attempted to homogenize belief and practice within the backward city-states, there was an attempt to co-opt the joyous and unholy pagan celebration by declaring it the Christ Mass. We call that time the Dark Ages, for good reason. A time of faith and loyalty to the leader. Among English-speaking peoples, it was Charles Dickens who repopularized the celebration in the 19th century, not only with his serial newspaper stories, but with direct exhortation. So, Merry Christmas, and don't forget to buy condoms. You know, I get tired of the ignorance. I don't know where to start. Now, let's get down to the news you're not supposed to know. The U.S. apparently is targeting Venezuela, and it would appear that since the U.S. can't get an ideological foothold in Venezuela, they're going to Cubaize it. I think these articles should explain. First, from the Wayne Madsen Report, a Venezuelan oil pipeline suspiciously sabotaged before the election, boycotted by the U.S.-backed opposition. And what clearly has the marks of U.S. neocon destabilization campaign, a pipeline to Venezuela's Amecardon oil refinery was blown up by terrorists on December 3rd on the eve of Sunday elections that returned President Hugo Chavez's Fifth Republic movement to the National Assembly with well over a two-thirds majority, a majority that will enable the Constitution to be changed to allow Chavez to run for a third term in 2012. Chavez will run for a re-election to a second six-year term next year. Working with local right-wing groups, the Bush administration supported a right-wing boycott of the legislative elections. Vice President Jose Vicente Rangel and Energy Minister Rafael Ramirez confirmed the explosion was sabotaged. In October, another pipeline was sabotaged in Zulia State. Wayne Madsen reported on November 9th that Vatang Agranov, who has several other names, an Israeli national, was arrested in nearby Trinidad for suspicion that he was involved in July 11th, August 10th, September 10th, and November 3rd bombings in the port of Spain. The bombings injured 28 people. Agranov was also caught possessing a stolen Trinidad and Tobago immigration visa extension stamp. Can't get an extension? Just steal the stamp. Israelis are not required to have a visa to enter Trinidad, but they are required to have one to enter Venezuela. An extended Trinidad visa would, however, permit easy entry into Venezuela from Trinidad, especially on small boats that ferry people between the 7-mile Gulf of Paria Strait that separates the two nations. WMR speculated at the time of his arrest for possible involvement in bombings in Trinidad that Agranov may have been involved in a false flag plot to engage in anti-Chavez sabotage in Venezuela. Prior to the April 2002 abortive U.S.-backed coup against Chavez, remember that? U.S. special ops personnel on loan to the CIA attempted to foment disruption of the state-owned PDVSA oil infrastructure. The Trinidad police believed Agranov was going to falsify his passport to remain in the country illegally. The Israeli embassy in Caracas intervened in the Agranov arrest, as did, suspiciously, the FBI. Caribbean law enforcement agencies possess intelligence that Agranov is a suspected terrorist. Agranov was deported from Trinidad to Israel on November 15th after the Israeli consulate in Port of Spain paid his bail. Now here's another article on the same thing. This from VenezuelaAnalysis.com. A major Venezuelan oil pipeline was bombed the night before Venezuela's elections. The president of Venezuela's state petrol company PDVSA, Rafael Ramirez, said groups trying to create a climate of violence in our country were involved in this. The bomb destroyed part of the Ulay Amoe oil pipeline at 9:30 p.m. on Saturday night. I think that's December, early December. The pipeline goes from the center of Venezuela's oil industry, Lake Maracaibo, to Paraguana. The Paraguana oil complex is the world's largest oil refinery. Ramirez said that a large fire was created by the bomb, but it was quickly put out. The pipeline normally supplies the Paraguana refinery with 400,000 barrels of oil a day. Ramirez said that within 2 days, the pipe should be fixed. Production should not be interrupted as the refinery had 5 days' worth of oil to process when the attack took place. Ha ha, how do you like that, neocons? Ramirez blamed opposition activists. The PDVSA president said, "The same people behind the oil sabotage 3 years ago are trying to create fear in our country." The Venezuelan Minister of the Interior said his ministry knows who is behind the situation And we've made some arrests. Government officials said 24 kilos of the military explosive C4 were discovered on Friday in Zulia by Venezuelan military operatives. Other weapons and grenades were also discovered. Government officials said C4 was used to attack the pipeline. So, just another front in the neocon war on popular determination or democracy anywhere. If there's anything they hate, it's popular participation and democracy. You're listening to Press Watch. It's 9:42. This is KBOO Portland. This from editor and publisher, changing the subject. Why did the U.S. military mislead the media? And the families of 10 Marines killed near the Iraqi city of Fallujah while on patrol last week about how they were killed. Departing from the text here, one of those was in Oregon, so the flags are at half-mast, and so I thought people might be interested to hear this. Returning to the text, the military announced on Tuesday that it actually happened at a promotion ceremony, and they were not on foot patrol, as initially reported. Families of the victims immediately raised questions about the incident, and it was unclear whether the site had been properly swept for explosive devices. The Marines were in a disused flour mill on the outskirts of the city to celebrate the promotion of 3 soldiers. A military statement said on Tuesday, as the ceremony ended, the Marines dispersed, and one of them is thought to have stepped on a buried pressure plate linked to explosives that caused the devastating blast. But CNN, for example, reported 4 days ago, based on military reports, that the dead Marines were conducting a nighttime foot patrol when a roadside bomb fashioned with large artillery shells detonated. And there's various excuses. I'm departing from the text now, coming out from the military as to why they said that lie. And the attack came just a day after President George W. Bush had given a speech outlining his strategy for Iraq and saying he would settle for nothing less than complete victory. Well, now, I think this story is interesting for another reason, and that is that the numbers of attacks are increasing. I wouldn't say exponentially, but they're really increasing. And I'm kind of wondering if the Green Zone is going to become Dien Bien Phu 2 sometime in the next couple of months. A grim thought, but, you know, heck, we're invading people, and people are defending themselves, and what can I say? I could say a lot of things, but I found an excellent speech by Harold Pinter. He's a British playwright and this year's Nobel Literature Prize winner. Wednesday, he delivered a searing attack on U.S. foreign policy, and this is from Der Spiegel on the English language website. As controversy regarding extraordinary renditions and allegations of U.S. torture continued, Pinter criticized Washington for the war in Iraq and supporting every right-wing military dictatorship of the past 50 years. And, you know, when I read it, excuse me, I thought, this guy is really saying it all. And so I'd like to pass on part of that to you. He said the majority of politicians, on the evidence available to us, are interested not in truth but in power and in the maintenance of that power. To maintain that power, it is essential that people remain in ignorance, that they live in ignorance of the truth, even the truth of their own lives. What surrounds us, therefore, is a vast tapestry of lies upon which we feed. As every single person here knows, the justification for the invasion of Iraq was that Saddam Hussein possessed a highly dangerous body of weapons of mass destruction, some of which could be fired in 45 minutes, bringing about appalling devastation. We were assured that was true. It was not true. We were told that Iraq had a relationship with Al-Qaeda and shared responsibility for the atrocity in New York of September 11, 2001. We were assured that this was true. It was not true. We were told that Iraq threatened the security of the world. We were assured it was true. It was not true. The truth is something entirely different. The truth is to do with how the United States understands its role in the world and how it chooses to embody it. But before I come back to the present, I would like to look at the recent past, by which I mean the United States foreign policy since the end of the Second World War. I believe it is obligatory upon us to subject this period to at least some kind of even limited scrutiny, which is all that time will allow here. Everyone knows what happened in the Soviet Union and throughout Eastern Europe during the post-war period, the systematic brutality, the widespread atrocities, the ruthless suppression of independent thought. All this has been fully documented and verified, but my contention here is that the U.S. crimes in the same period have only been superficially recorded, let alone documented, let alone acknowledged, let alone recognized as crimes at all. I believe this must be addressed, and that the truth has considerable bearing on where the world stands now. Although constrained to a certain extent by the existence of the Soviet Union, the United States' actions throughout the world made it clear that it had concluded it had carte blanche to do what it liked. Direct invasion of a sovereign state, has never in fact been America's favored method. In the main, it has preferred what it has described as low-intensity conflict. Low-intensity conflicts means that thousands of people die, but slower than if you dropped a bomb on them in one fell swoop. It means that you infect the heart of the country, that you establish a malignant growth and watch the gangrene bloom. When the populace has been subdued or beaten to death, the same thing, and your own friends, the military and great corporations, sit comfortably in power, you go before the camera and say that democracy has prevailed. This was a commonplace in U.S. foreign policy in the years to which I refer. The tragedy of Nicaragua was a highly significant case. I choose to offer it here as a potent example of America's view of its role in the world, both then and now. Reading from Harold Pinter, Nobel Prize winner. I was present, he writes, at a meeting at the U.S. Embassy in London in the late 1980s, the United States Congress was about to decide whether to give more money to the Contras and their campaign against the state of Nicaragua. I was a member of a delegation speaking on behalf of Nicaragua, but the most important member of this delegation was Father John Metcalf. The leader of the U.S. body was Raymond Seitz, then number two to the ambassador, later ambassador himself. Father Metcalf said, "Sir, I'm in charge of a parish in the north of Nicaragua. My parishioners built a school, a health center, a cultural center. We have lived in peace. A few months ago, a Contra force attacked the parish. They destroyed everything, the school, the health center, the cultural center. They raped nurses and teachers, slaughtered doctors in the most brutal manner. They behaved like savages. Please demand that the U.S. government withdraw its support from this shocking terrorist activity." Raymond Seitz had a very good reputation as a rational, responsible, and highly sophisticated man. He was greatly respected in diplomatic circles. He listened, paused, and then spoke with some gravity. "Father," he said, "let me tell you something. In war, innocent people always suffer." There was a frozen silence. We stared at him. He did not flinch. "Innocent people indeed always suffer." Finally, someone said, "but in this case, innocent people were the victims of a gruesome atrocity subsidized by your government, one among many. If Congress allows the Contras more money, further atrocities of this kind will take place. Is this not the case? Is your government not therefore guilty of supporting acts of murder and destruction upon the citizens of a sovereign state?" Seitz was imperturbable. "I don't agree that the facts as presented support your assertions," he said. As we were leaving the embassy, a U.S. aide told me that he enjoyed my plays. I did not reply. Once again, reading from the writings of Harold Pinter, Nobel Prize-winning playwright. He writes, "I should remind you that at the time President Reagan made the following statement, the Contras are the moral equivalent of our founding fathers. The United States supported the brutal Somoza dictatorship in Nicaragua for over 40 years. The Nicaraguan people, led by the Sandinistas, overthrew this regime in 1979, a breathtaking popular revolution. The Sandinistas weren't perfect. They possessed their fair share of arrogance, and their political philosophy contained a number of contradictory elements. But they were intelligent, rational, and civilized. They set out to establish a stable, decent, pluralistic society. The death penalty was abolished. Hundreds of thousands of poverty-stricken peasants were brought back from the dead. Over 100,000 families were given title to land. 2,000 schools were built. A quite remarkable literacy campaign reduced illiteracy in the country to less than 1/7. Free education was established and a free health service. Infant mortality was reduced by a third. Polio was eradicated. The United States denounced these achievements as Marxist-Leninist subversion. In the view of the U.S. government, a dangerous example was being set. If Nicaragua was allowed to establish basic norms of social and economic justice, if it was allowed to raise the standards of health care and education and achieve social unity and national self-respect, neighboring countries would ask the same questions and do the same things. There was, of course, at the time, fierce resistance to the status quo in El Salvador. I spoke earlier about a tapestry of lies which surrounds us. President Reagan commonly described Nicaragua as a totalitarian dungeon. This was taken generally by the media, and certainly by the British government, as accurate and fair comment. But in fact, there was in fact no record of death squads under the Sandinista government. There was no record of torture. There was no record of systematic or official military brutality. No priests were ever murdered in Nicaragua by the Sandinistas. There were in fact three priests in the government, two Jesuits and a Marinole missionary. The totalitarian dungeons were actually next door. In El Salvador and Guatemala, the United States had brought down the democratically elected government of Guatemala in 1954, and it is estimated that over 200,000 people had been victims of successive military dictatorships. Six of the most distinguished Jesuits in the world were viciously murdered at the Central America University in San Salvador in 1989 by a battalion of the Atlacotl Regiment trained at Fort Benning, Georgia, USA. That extremely brave man, Archbishop Romero, was assassinated while saying Mass. It is estimated that 75,000 people died. Why were they killed? They were killed because they believed a better life was possible and should be achieved. That belief immediately qualified them as communists. They died because they dared to question the status quo. The endless plateau of poverty, disease, degradation, and oppression, which had been their birthright. The United States finally brought down the Sandinista government. It took some years and considerable resistance, but relentless economic persecution and 30,000 dead finally undermined the spirit of the Nicaraguan people. They were exhausted and poverty-stricken once again. The casinos moved back into the country. Free health and free education were over. Big business returned with a vengeance. Democracy had prevailed. But this policy was by no means restricted to Central America. It was conducted throughout the world. It was never ending. And it is as if it never happened. The United States supported and in many cases engendered every right-wing military dictatorship in the world after the end of the Second World War. I refer to Indonesia, Greece, Uruguay, Brazil, Paraguay, Haiti, Turkey, the Philippines, Guatemala, El Salvador, and of course Chile. The horror the United States inflicted upon Chile in 1973 can never be purged and can never be forgiven. Hundreds of thousands of deaths took place throughout these countries. Did they take place? And are they in all cases attributable to U.S. foreign policy? The answer is yes, they did take place, and they are attributable to U.S. foreign policy. But you wouldn't know it. It never happened. Nothing ever happened. Even while it was happening, it wasn't happening. It didn't matter. It was of no interest. The crimes of the United States have been systematic, constant, vicious, remorseless. But very few people have actually talked about them. You have to hand it to America. It has exercised a quite clinical manipulation of power worldwide while masquerading as a force for universal good. It's a brilliant, even witty, highly successful act of hypnosis. I put to you that the United States is without doubt the greatest show on the road. Brutal, indifferent, scornful, and ruthless, but it may be, but it is also very clever. As a salesman, it is out on its own, and its most saleable commodity is self-love. It's a winner. Listen to all the American presidents on television say the words, "the American people," as in the sentence, "I say to the American people, it is time to pray and to defend the rights of the American people, and I ask the American people to trust their president in the action he is about to take on behalf of the American people." It's a scintillating stratagem. Language is actually employed to keep thought at bay. The words, "the American people," provide a truly voluptuous cushion of reassurance. You don't need to think. Just lie back on the cushion. The cushion may be suffocating your intelligence and your critical faculties, but it's very comfortable. This does not apply, of course, to the 40 million people living below the poverty line and the 2 million men and women imprisoned in the vast gulag of prisons which extends across the U.S. The United States no longer bothers about low-intensity conflict. It no longer sees any point in being reticent or even devious. It puts its cards on the table without fear or favor. It quite simply doesn't give a damn about the United Nations, international law, or critical dissent, which it regards as impotent and irrelevant. It also has its own bleeding little lamb tagging behind it on a lead, the pathetic and supine Great Britain. What has happened to our moral sensibility? Did we ever have any? What do these words mean? Do they refer to a term rarely employed these days, conscience? A conscience to do not only with our own acts, but to do with our shared responsibility and the acts of others? Is all this dead? Look at Guantanamo Bay. Hundreds of people detained without charge over 3 years. With no legal representation or due process, technically detained forever. This is totally illegitimate. This totally illegitimate structure is maintained in defiance of the Geneva Convention. It is not only tolerated, but hardly thought about by what's called the international community. This criminal outrage is being committed by a country which declares itself to be the leader of the free world. Do we think about the inhabitants of Guantanamo Bay? What does the media say about them? They pop up occasionally, a small item on page 6. They have been consigned to a no-man's land from which, indeed, they may never return. At present, many are on hunger strike being force-fed, including British residents. No niceties in these force-feeding procedures. No sedative or anesthetic. Just a tube stuck up your nose and into your throat. You vomit blood, this is torture. What has the British Foreign Secretary said about this? Nothing. What has the British Prime Minister said about this? Nothing. Why not? Because the United States has said to criticize our conduct in Guantanamo Bay constitutes an unfriendly act. You're either with us or against us, so Blair shuts up. The invasion of Iraq was a bandit act, an act of blatant state terrorism, demonstrating absolute contempt for the concept of international law. The invasion was an arbitrary military action inspired by a series of lies upon lies and gross manipulation of the media and therefore of the public. An act intended to consolidate American military and economic control of the Middle East, masquerading as a last resort, all other justifications having failed to justify themselves, as liberation. A formidable assertion of military force responsible for the death and mutilation of thousands and thousands of innocent people. We have brought torture, cluster bombs, depleted uranium, innumerable acts of random murder, misery, degradation, and death to the Iraqi people, and call it bringing freedom and democracy to the Middle East. How many people do you have to kill before you qualify to be described as a mass murderer and a war criminal? 100,000? More than enough, I would have thought. Therefore, it is just that Bush and Blair be arraigned before the International Criminal Court of Justice. But Bush has been clever. He has not ratified the International Criminal Court of Justice. Therefore, if any American soldier, or for that matter, politician, finds himself in the dock, Bush has warned that he will send in the Marines. But Tony Blair has ratified the court and is therefore available for prosecution. We can let the court have his address if they're interested. It's number 10 Downing Street, London. Death in this context is irrelevant. Both Bush and Blair placed death well away on the back burner. At least 100,000 Iraqis were killed by American bombs and missiles before the Iraq insurgency began. These people are of no moment. Their deaths don't exist. They are blank. They are not even recorded as being dead. We don't do body counts, said the American general, Tommy Franks. Early in the invasion, there was a photograph published on the front page of British newspapers of Tony Blair kissing the cheek of a little Iraqi boy. A grateful child, said the caption. A few days later, there was a story and a photograph on an inside page of another four-year-old boy with no arms. His family had been blown up by a missile. He was the only survivor. When do I get my arms back? He asked. The story was dropped. While Tony Blair wasn't holding him in his arms, nor the body of any other mutilated child, nor the body of any bloody corpse. Blood is dirty. It dirties your shirt and tie when you're making a sincere speech on television. The 2,000 American dead are an embarrassment. They are transported to their graves in the dark. Funerals are unobtrusive, out of harm's way. The mutilated rot in their beds, some for the rest of their lives. So the dead and the mutilated both rot in different kinds of graves. There's more to Mr. Pinter's speech, and I encourage you to read it. And you can find it on Der Spiegel's English internet service. I found it quite impressive. You're listening to Press Watch, and just about out of time. So I thought I'd comment, well, actually report. This from Jim Loeb, the Interpress Service. The world has suffered more than $200 billion in economic losses as a result of weather-related natural disasters over the past year, making 2005 the costliest year on record, according to preliminary estimates released Tuesday by the Munich Re Foundation at the International Climate Conference in Montreal. These damages significantly exceeded the previous record of $145 billion set in 2004. According to the foundation, which is part of Munich Re, one of several leading reinsurance companies that have warned repeatedly over the past decade that global warming posed serious threats to the world's economy. And I'm glad to say there have been protests against global warming. If you'd like to see part of the PressWatch script, go to presswatch.blogspot.com. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for more of the incomparable Radio Zine. Thank you.
Good morning. Buenas tardes. I'm Eduardo de Landeros Tierre, and we have a special program for you this morning on the posadas that are taking place in Mexico right now, and the celebrations around a great feminine figure called the Guadalupe, the Virgin Guadalupe. But first, this cable program has been made possible in part by Cable Foundation members and a grant from, in other words, women's books and resources, and it's your local nonprofit feminist bookstore and resource center offering community space, events, gifts, tools for the revolution, a comprehensive collection of women's writings, and a lot more. It's located at 3734 Southeast Hawthorne, and it's on the web at www.inotherwords.org. I'm also joined this morning by Gloria King. Good morning, Gloria.
Good morning, Eduardo.
Yeah, we have a special treat for the listeners this morning, so why don't you tell them what's coming up?
Yeah, we want to talk about the posadas and how they start in Mexico from December 16 until the 24th, that is the Noche Buena in Mexico. And usually there are parties that everybody has at home, and they kind of sing and they dance and they eat and they drink too, and they're really fun.
That's backtracked on the significance. There's something coming up on December 12th. So it's
that is very important day in the Mexican Catholic religion, because the Virgin of Guadalupe has a party on December 12th. And actually on December 11th, a lot of people, they travel from all over to Mexico, all the other states, and they go to Mexico City to be at the Basilica of Guadalupe. That is the place where the party starts, because on December 12th, everybody has a big mass and people just get crazy about the Virgin of Guadalupe, because she looks like the regular Mexicans. She looks like indígena, and her skin color is kind of dark. So it's very important for the Mexicans.
Yes, I've seen that image. Of course, I've seen I've seen images of the Virgin Guadalupe in this country. They make her white. But in Mexico, she's brown.
She's like most of the Mexicans.
Yeah, like me. Yeah. I guess. You selected some songs as sort of to give a flavor of what's going on right now. So let's start out with that first song. What's the first song we're coming up to give everybody?
This is the song Entre Santos y Peregrinos, que es una canción que se canta en las posadas. It's a song that is very popular on the posadas.
Okay, so let's give a listen, and we'll come back. Gloria, let's look briefly at, I don't want to get too academic about it, I guess, because it's not about that, but I would like people to know what this song is about, and so.
Yeah, this is the song that people sing when they have the procession or the posadas. The posadas means that people, they take the Virgin Maria and Jose.
Jose
like a figures, you know, and then they kind of walk and they are singing those songs, and they are usually outside of their houses asking for to be inside. So they usually sing those kind of songs, and it's before the posada starts.
Okay, now we're coming up with another song, and what's the name of it?
Entre confites y canciones.
And meaning?
Y canelones, I'm sorry. It is the song that is the same thing. All those songs, they mean that people wants to be in the party and they want to start.
Okay, so
the party going.
Let's get a flavor for this.
Leche, confites y canelones para los muchachos que son glotones. Piña madura, castaña asada, vivan los de la posada. Piña madura, castaña asada, vivan los de la posada. Ándale, Juana, no te dilates con la canasta de los cacahuates. Ándale, Juana, no te dilates con la canasta de los cacahuates. Ándale, Juana, sal de rincón con la canasta de la colación. Ándale, Juana, sal de rincón la canasta de la colación. Y no te escondas en la cocina, o ya verás con mi tía Catalina. Y no te escondas en la cocina, o ya verás con mi tía Catalina. No quiero oro ni quiero plata, yo lo que quiero es romper la piñata. No quiero oro ni quiero plata, yo lo que quiero es romper la piñata.
The rhythms, and again, I don't want to get academic, but it still had that same feel as the first song. And just tell people what they were singing in this song, too.
In this song, they were asking that they want to kind of break the piñata and get some things, you know, because the piñatas, they have, I don't know, candies and small toys inside. And the piñatas are something very important in the posadas. Usually when you have a posada, you should have a piñata. Otherwise, the posada is not going to be complete.
I want to also mention that there's a growing Latino community in Oregon, you know, with Bern, Portland too, Salem. And these, the posadas and the Guadalupe, of course, are very important. But they're celebrated in different ways because it's not celebrated just by Mexicanos. I mean, I've seen, you know, Guatemaltecos, the Guatemalan people taking part of this. It's a community-wide thing, and it's interesting for me how to see how that changes. But what's going on right now in Mexico, you know, the celebrations, it's still different, you know. I want to also talk about with what's going on in Chiapas and in other places where there's change taking place. What's the significance of this, the Virgin Guadalupe, to them, to the indigenous people, you know, and especially during December, you know, in their struggle? Can you comment about that?
Yeah, I think in general for all the Mexicans, the Virgin of Guadalupe is very important because she gives you the power to keep going, even when things are not the way that you want that they should be, or even when you don't have money or you are poor or things are kind of bad. People always recur to the Virgin of Guadalupe. They pray to her, they ask for help, and they feel that she really helps them back.
For you, could you tell me the significance? I mean, you growing up as a woman, and what does the symbolism and the significance of the Guadalupe has meant for you?
I think as a Mexican, it makes me feel like I'm very proud that I have my own Virgin, and she looks like me and my relatives, and we even have her big Basilica de Guadalupe in Mexico City. And we have the piece of fabric where she, that was the miracle where she was painted. You know, she looks right there and we can see that fabric on the...
Oh, the fabric.
Yeah. I think, I don't know if you know something about the history of the Virgin of Guadalupe.
Well, let's give a little short version of that for everybody.
Okay. It's supposed to be like she just appeared and talked to one of the indigenous. And she told him that she was the mother of Jesucristo. And she wanted to have a church in one mountain. But she told him to talk to the priests. Spaniards, priests, and he explained that, and then they didn't believe him, so she kind of put her picture in a piece of fabric, so when he showed that to the priest, they really believed that there was a Virgin of Guadalupe.
Okay. Now, let's do one more song, and let's intro this, and what's the name of the song coming up?
The song coming out is Versos de Pedir Posadas.
Okay, let's give a listen. Those notes, we have a live guest. We have somebody from Mexico right now on the telephone that's going to talk to us about what's going on there in terms of the Posada and the celebrations. Gloria, introduce this person.
Hello.
Hola.
Hola, papá. Estamos aquí en un programa de radio y queremos preguntarte cómo es el espíritu navideño ahora en la Ciudad de México.
Está muy bonito, todo está iluminado con motivos navideños y luces de muchos colores.
Yeah, I just asked my father how is the holidays in Mexico, and he said that everything is so pretty, that there are a lot of lights around the streets, and yeah, he feels that people are getting ready for Christmas. ¿Qué clase de cosas se venden más ahora en los mercados, en los tiendas?
Muchas series navideñas, imágenes de la Virgen María y San José, animalitos de barro, y infinidad de regalitos para la familia de este fin de año.
Yeah, he was saying that on the markets you can buy nativity sets and a lot of candies and Virgins of Guadalupe and just things for Christmas. Papá, y hablando acerca de la Virgen de Guadalupe, ¿qué me puedes decir de los preparativos que se están realizando ahora?
Pues bastante vigilancia para poder atender a más de 7 millones de peregrinos que la vienen a ver.
Yeah,
servicios médicos. Mucha vigilancia.
He said that there are a lot of things going on because usually there are 7 million of people that they go to visit the Virgin of Guadalupe at the Basilica in Mexico City. ¿Quieres decir algo más?
Pues nada más, que la pasen muy bien. Feliz Navidad para todos y próspero año nuevo.
Yo tengo una pregunta. ¿Tú vas a ir a entrar a la Basílica también o no?
No creo que vaya porque tengo 71 años y me expongo a peligros caminando.
Entonces, tú solamente vas a celebrar en casa, ¿eh?
En casa, viendo la televisión.
¿Con comida?
Sí, claro.
¿Qué tipo de comida?
Romeritos con camarones y papas.
I'm getting hungry already. I'm getting hungry. Okay, gracias. Que te vaya bien. Gracias.
Igualmente. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.
Feliz Navidad.
Gracias,
Feliz
papá.
Feliz Navidad también. ¿Es todo, hija?
Sí, todo. Besos y abrazos. Adiós.
Bueno, adiós.
Um, I was asking him about, since it, I'm always interested in the culinary aspects, and so they're going to have some home cooking there. Tell me what he, for the people who didn't quite get the Spanish on that, what the food is going to be about.
Oh.
Home cooking de las paredes.
Yeah. In Las Posadas, we usually have tamales. I believe that everybody knows tamales. We have, I don't know, hot chocolate. We have punch.
What type of hot chocolate? It's not just, not Nestle's, right?
It's kind of Spanish hot chocolate that we usually have with a little bit of cinnamon. So it's kind of a little bit spicier than the regular one. And then we have, a lot of candies like fruit with sugar, or we have buñuelos. Buñuelos are more like flour tortillas that they fry, and then they put some honey around, and then they have colaciones. Colaciones are the special candies for Christmas, and you just can buy them on Christmas time, and they are really good too. And they're not expensive. They're very inexpensive, actually.
Well, on the note of comida and food, I have something to announce. There's going to be a Latino desayuno breakfast coming up in celebration of what is called the celebration of our Guadalupe. It's taking place December 12th, and it's going to be traditional music, and there's going to be a procession and a mass, and of course, breakfast. And it's going to take place, starts at 7:30 a.m., it takes place at the St. Francis Church. It's on Southeast 12th, just down the street from the station. And then, at 7:30, then the procession starts with traditional songs, and they're going to meet at the corner of the I-84 in MLK. And then, at 7:45 a.m., they're going to walk to the corner of 6th and Burnside. And the reason I mention it is, apart from the food part, is that this particular celebration and Latino breakfast, it's being done by the Hortaleros, the Mexican day workers around the corner from us that always you see them standing on the corner there on Ankeny and 8th and Burnside. And these workers are having this breakfast, and it's traditional for them. Once again, all are invited. The breakfast is free. What can I say about that? It's December 12th at St. Francis Church. It's on Southeast 12th. And Gloria, you had another like a posada taking place, I guess.
Yeah, for the people that they want to celebrate the posadas, it's going to be one on December 17th from 7 to 9 at the Centro Cultural of Washington County on Cornelius, Oregon.
And now we have another song to introduce. And let's tell people what this song is.
This is Dale, Dale, Dale. That's the special song for when you are breaking the piñata. So it's very popular too.
Breaking the piñata. Okay, let's break this cut. I wanted to again look at the figure of the Virgen Guadalupe, that female figure. So it's so important. It has been important in my life because my mother was born in Chihuahua in Mexico. And it was really important to her. And I remember her burning the candles and also making the food for us. And I, as a child, I was looked at that figure, and I was always mystified by it. And she was beautiful to me. something magical, you know. Gloria, can you expound on that? Is this something that was just me feeling, or is this something that...
I think it's something that most of the Mexicans, and not just Mexicans, because now the Virgin of Guadalupe is very important on all Latin America and all over the world, because it's getting more popular. But you feel so close to her because you kind of feel like you talk right there with her. You don't need to go to the Vatican. It's right there in your country. You can just see her, and she looks like you, and you feel more comfortable, and you feel like she really listened to you. I don't know how to explain it exactly with words. It's just a strong feeling or peace.
Entonces, ¿y si puedes explicar eso también en español?
Sí, la mayoría de los mexicanos estamos súper arraigados a la Virgen de Guadalupe porque es una virgen mexicana. En un principio se apareció en México y era para los mexicanos. Ahora se ha convertido en la virgen de muchos, muchos católicos, no solamente latinos, no solamente latinoamericanos, también hay americanos, hay europeos que creen mucho en la Virgen de Guadalupe. Y la mayoría pensamos que ella está ahí, que cuando le hablamos nos escucha y que está muy cercana a nosotros porque se parece a nosotros los latinos y porque se creó en nuestro país, en nuestro continente, América.
We are in radio, of course, so could you paint again a image of what the Guadalupe looks like? And we mentioned before the skin color, so you want to do that again?
She looks like a young woman. She has dark skin. Her face shows some peace, and she has like magueyes on her feet and two angels. And they don't look too white, too. So, and then the color of her dress is kind of gold and has some little stars. So, she looks kind of colorful. And she looks different than the regular virgins from Europe, you know. So, she has more that Latin flavor.
You mentioned the plant that's at her feet. Could you go into the symbolism of that?
Magueyes?
Yeah.
Yeah. That means that she is in a Mexican land. You know, she's right there and in Mexico, in Latin America.
And the symbolism of the stars? Let's go into all that. I'm fascinated by that. Well, for you?
For me, it's like showing that she's close to heaven, that she's close to God, that she's right there to help you with whatever you need, so she will talk to God, and then they will help you.
I think it's probably necessary to also explain again the story of the Guadalupe and her appearance. Could you explain that?
Uh-huh. La Virgen de Guadalupe se aparece en México, en una montaña, se le aparece a un pobre campesino, Juan Diego, y le dijo que hablara con los sacerdotes católicos españoles para que les avisara que ella era la madre de los mexicanos y que los iba a ayudar. Él fue con los sacerdotes, les explicó, no le entendieron y no le creyeron, entonces regresó con ella y ella le dijo, tráeme rosas. Pero él pensaba, ¿cómo rosas? En diciembre no hay rosas. Pero encontró las rosas, se las puso en una manta, en un huipil que le llaman, y cuando se acercó a ella, le dijo a ella, ya tienes tu prueba, ve con los sacerdotes y explícales que yo existo. Les das estas rosas y les explicas eso. Entonces fue con los sacerdotes, se bajó el huipil, la manta, y les dijo que existía, y vio la imagen impresa de la Virgen de Guadalupe en esa manta, que es la misma que está en la Basílica de Guadalupe hoy en día.
Brevemente en inglés, porque...
Okay. There is a huipil, or piece of fabric, that has the image of the Virgin of Guadalupe, and that is a miracle that she made for let the people know that she exists. And that is in the Basilica of Guadalupe in Mexico City.
You mentioned the roses.
Yeah. This indigena has some roses that he kind of put inside of this fabric. And then the Virgin told him, okay, if nobody believes you, they will believe you later. So just show these roses to them and tell that I am exist.
Well, that brings us to a close on this program. I wanted to do this special program because it's so significant to Mexico right now, and it's also still significant to the Latino community in the United States, and it's so important in our area too. And I just thought that. Do something. I mean, we could go on for hours on this figure, this fascinating indigenous figure, a female figure that goes back, hundreds of years, But I just wanted to give everybody just a flavor. So I am Eduardo de Landeros Tierra, and you?
Soy Gloria.
And it was a pleasure. And paz, arte, Feliz Navidad.
Feliz Navidad. Y feliz año nuevo.
Terre peut-être. Well, I love cubism. It's my favorite style. When I see a cubist painting, I just gotta smile. But there's one painter I'm his biggest fan. He's the father of cubism. His name's Cézanne. Cézanne, 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 the father of cubism. Well, some people say that it was Picasso.
Good morning. I am very delighted this morning. There's something a little different we're going to talk about this morning. It's a different subject matter for Art Focus. And this morning, Ashley Rowland, the artistic director of the dance group called Body Vox, is here this morning. And her husband, Jamie Hampton, is also here. Welcome to KBOO once again.
Thank you very much, Julie.
I think you've both been on before.
We
from
have.
Time to time.
We have. Yes.
And I'm very pleased to have been at the discussion the other morning in Body Vox itself upstairs in the, where is it located, Jamie, please, again?
Oh, that's the Body Vox studio, yeah, which is,
studio.
We like to say it's on the third floor of the Bridgeport Brewery. we think we're the only modern dance company that's over a brewery. It's on 13th and Northrop, Northwest, in the Pearl.
In the Pearl,
yeah.
Okay. Now, Ashley was on before one time some years ago, and we had the photographer here also who is
Lois Greenfield.
Lois Greenfield. And Lois Greenfield took the fantastically beautiful pictures of you both leaping about that all people have seen. Because it was on a signboard, where
we Milwaukee. We did the world campaign for the Raymond Weil watches, and that was out probably almost 10 years ago, I think. But it did show up here in Portland, off the Morrison Bridge, and a few other locations around town, which was kind of startling. I was in a bikini, flying all over the town I lived in.
I was in a mall in Montevideo, Uruguay,
mm-hmm.
and saw a photo of Ashley jumping around for Raymond Weil watches. And then I knew that this campaign truly was global.
Right.
Yeah.
It was fascinating when we did the ad campaign. Because it was global, it also went to the Middle East. And the women couldn't wear the bikinis that I mentioned before. And for the shots in the Middle East, we were dressed in turtlenecks and covered all the way to the ankle.
Oh.
And they just had us sort of dripping in from the edges of the frame, which was a different take, I guess, on dance photography.
Yeah.
just drip. Drip in.
Oh, dripped in.
Dripped in instead of jumping in the middle of the frame. We were just
speaking of dripping in some of your performances, you've used a lot of water. Do you want to explain that between the two of you? What kind of, we're going to talk about costumes quite a bit if we can, because it suddenly became a very important subject to me as an art form and a different way of thinking about wearing art in order to express what you want, you need to do in the dance. And did I say it right? I'm talking a different language in a way for me, but
the costumes sort of are the art direction of the show, along with the sets, and then the music sort of adds another dimension, but visually, I think the costumes and the sets really create, obviously, the setting. And like a sculptor, the costumes being made out of different materials create different energies and different movement possibilities and different visual ideas, suggesting to the audience many different things, where you are, or the costume is the prop and, you know, it's got humor to it, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. I'm looking here at a costume that actually was designed by Michael Curry. Did you help him with that design?
The design was done by Ashley, and Michael...
Oh, was it? Okay.
She gave him the design, and Michael is brilliant at figuring out, I mean, not only designing for himself, but also figuring out how to realize sort of ambitious design. And this photo that you're holding is a photo of a giant calla lily. And Ashley had the idea that this piece that we were working on called Reverie would take place in a garden. And we originally created the piece to premiere in a garden. It was actually a present to Walter Jaffe and Paul King. The creation of the piece, we made it as a gift to them. And
the two gentlemen of Whitebird.
Of Whitebird, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the piece premiered in a garden, and so we decided to do a piece that was sort of about a garden. And Ashley designed these costumes. The men are bamboo, and the women are lilies, a calla lily and a tiger lily. So she gave these sketches to Michael Curry, and he figured out how to make them. And
the credit really grows to him for his painting. Because mm-hmm. I sketched on color and suggested what I wanted them to look like, going all the way down to the shape of the lily, taking a sort of a greenish to white to then a rosy hue by the bottom of the skirt, then the unitards underneath being yellow, sort of like the pistol or the centerpiece of the calla lily, and then the shoe being sort of the dark, rich tip of the stamen, is it? The very mm-hmm. top of the flower. And then he took those suggestions and hand-painted them and did a beautiful job.
I think this is indicative of a subtle way that we approach costuming and that we approach design in all of our shows. I don't think an audience would look at that and necessarily intellectually say, oh, there's the stamen, the pistol, the flower. but they are getting it on a subtle level. And this is true with all of our design. I mean, some of our stuff is really bold and brash and kind of outrageous, but a lot of it operates on a pretty subtle level. And our theater that we create, we like to say we create a total theater with light mm-hmm. and sound and costumes and movement. And all of these elements work together synergistically to create this impression that takes place on many different levels. So there's subtle level things going on as well as the things that are kind of impressing you that are easy to talk about in a way.
Sure. Well, I noticed that when you pick up a costume to show it to people and it hasn't got the body in it, it sort of lies
yes,
there with
rather
things
pathetic, aren't they?
Lifeless.
They are very lifeless.
And shells.
So when you conceive, you need to see the dance first, and then you design the costume to increase your imagination. Or what? Tell me how does this work?
It depends. I think it goes
you
either way.
You try lots of stuff.
We don't have a formula,
we do
actually.
Try. We do. Mm-hmm. Actually, in this last show we just finished at Lincoln Hall this past October called Civilization Unplugged, I had some costumes built, and it was sort of a wing and a prayer that we would make these costumes work. And they were pieces of fabric, beautiful, beautiful, shiny sort of pieces of fabric, allowing the dancers to be able to have total freedom with their legs. So they look like sort of skirts with these panels coming off. And then continuing that theme up into a top, where the top was sort of patchworked, put together like a patchwork. And then the men had sort of a similar pant that was patchwork and a top that was patchwork. And we got these costumes back, and they looked like some horrible album cover from Rufus and Chaka Khan. These like denim jeans sewn together, just looking very, very Woodstock. And I don't know. Mm-hmm. And so we all of a sudden had to gather what worked, which were the skirts, and then kind of get rid of the other stuff and accessorize and minimize. And we came up with something that I think really worked, which was we wore the skirts over a more pedestrian-looking pair of jeans and a blue top. And it was successful like that.
But we will use the other costumes when we go on tour as the backup dancers for Earth, Wind, and Fire next spring.
Okay.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
Yeah. I do think they're going to reappear, and they will reappear maybe in our spring show. We're doing a new piece for Mozart, and they're rather over the top, and it might be the perfect thing. But getting back to what you asked is if we conceive the costume first or we conceive the piece, it goes both ways, And that's kind of fun. The calla lilies came first, naturally, because we were doing the garden piece, and they're a big piece of construction. So that idea had to go out months before we ever did the piece. And in fact, we premiered the piece the day we got the costumes, which is a terrible challenge because you've never played in them, so you don't know how they react. And I shall say the first run at it was interesting. I think we were being poked in the eye and stabbed and whacking each other with petals and all sorts of hilarious mishaps going on with that.
And then but, was Michael there to see the
I don't think he was
initial
there. No, I don't.
Attempts.
I don't think he was there.
I think it's very beautiful just by itself when you held it up out there.
Uh-huh.
And I was convinced and am still convinced that it would have been a wonderful contribution to the biennial this year.
Very nice.
And I don't see any reason why you couldn't.
Oh, uh-huh. Good idea.
It's because you see, there's a different way of looking at art and so forth, and all the things that go with that, all the ideas that go with that, which I'm not going to go into right now because it would take me too long.
Well, but dance is an art form. It's a natural
The biennial could use a shot in the arm, you know, like that, I would think.
Oh.
So anyway, that's
okay.
maybe not this year, but
maybe we'll just crash
years
the reception wearing them.
Hey, that's
or our dinosaur costumes, like we keep threatening to crash the Rose Parade with our dinosaur costumes.
And in the famous movie where Jamie is playing with his lover, the machine.
Oh,
my lover,
the excavator.
Yeah, and could you describe that a little bit because we need to get the people up in Hood River to see this.
Oh, we do. Mm-hmm. We do. They would really appreciate it.
I think the first attempt at blending the vocation of construction and erecting of buildings with dance, which is a real natural. I don't know if anyone else sees
Remember,
that.
Yeah. Everybody who's listening, that this we're talking to dancers this morning, and we're talking about costumes and the approach to costuming and the action of this fabulous dance group called Body Vox.
Yeah, and you know, you can take a costume can be a prop also, and a prop can become a costume. And in the case of making Dear John, where I did a duet with a 23-ton excavator, it's really hard to choreograph that ahead of time because it's not like you can just get one of those and take it into the studio and work with it,
right?
You know, for weeks. So basically, I saw the tractor the morning that we started filming, and we did the whole thing in one day.
It's actually amazing how easy it is to rent those tractors. I was pretty impressed.
Really?
Well, Ashley phoned up United Rentals, and I think it helps if you call up and you put on a soft little innocent voice and just say, you know, I was just interested in renting the biggest excavator you have. And they said, well, okay, what time do you want it and where do you want it? And
all they wanted was a credit card, which amazed me. It shows up.
You don't even have to tell them you have a license.
You don't need insurance and you don't even need a driver. They figure if something so deadly is going to show up on your property, you're going to know how to use it.
Well, of course, we were going to do it. We were going to run it. But then we realized that probably we would kill somebody.
And I dreamt about that the whole night before.
And it would just be a steep learning curve. We would spend most of the day trying to figure out how to run it. So we got a wonderful friend of ours who has become a friend of ours to run it. But it was a great experience. Singly, probably the most intense day of creation that we've had. Probably. And at some points, like during the film, you see that the tractor really does kind of become a costume in a way, because there's really quite a lot of things you can do with a tractor with movement. You know, we also did another one on cherry pickers. We had four cherry pickers out in the Central Oregon Desert, and we did another beautiful film with that. We've looked at other heavy machinery, but we haven't really resonated with any other machinery besides those two. But oftentimes we'll go by and we'll see something and we'll kind of wonder, is there a piece in that? Is there a piece in one of those big pile drivers that drives the the girders into the ground to put up buildings. We wonder if there is.
Uh-huh. Well, they're fascinating to watch, and they're kind of hypnotic in a way.
Yeah.
Because they have a there's something about they do human things. Because they have a human innards,
yeah.
and it takes a human brain to work them.
We have anthropomorphized them,
yeah.
and they take on these short little stories, like a little Charlie Chaplin-esque or Buster Keaton-type vignette. So they're not just pure dance. There's a little story there with humor and.
Mm. Uh-huh.
And
but I think the key to both of those films is that they're sad.
Yes,
if they were just funny.
They're
melancholy. They end with a little tinge of longing and nostalgia and sadness in a way, even though.
Uh-huh.
And so you can use humor to tell a sad story. And that's very typical of Chaplin and
exactly.
Keaton.
Yes, and that's the best humor that ever is.
Well,
made,
maybe. You know, we have a lot of humor in our shows, and some of it is just funny. I mean, some of it's very funny, and some of it is funny to be sad.
Yeah.
So we actually like to work with humor a lot in our shows. Yeah, we're
well, sure. There's a poignancy is very important, I think, in a lot of what you do.
Yeah.
And there's a kind of a sweetness to it that is very appealing to the audience. But now I want to hear about the movies made under the water. Mm. And some of the costumery for that and how it worked out. Debbie, you told some interesting stories about what
happened.
Well,
we made one of these short films, which we call the series, excuse me, with the John Deere tractor and the Cherry Pickers, Modern Daydreams. It's a series of four short films. But we made another Modern Daydream, and it was about a man who works in a pet store selling fish. And he sort of has this fantasy about this customer, and he romanticizes it and imagines himself doing a duet with this customer woman, but they're both fish, and they're both specifically Siamese fighting fish, the betta fish, the little betta fish. You see them sitting in the little cups of water at the fish store, and they have those beautiful, long, feathery fins.
Yes.
And
you never see them together.
Because they tear each other to shreds.
They will kill each
other.
Yeah, so they're only, you can't put two fish together. So this duet that she did underwater was trying to resolve the tension of two fish that are going to tear each other apart but become romantic. And so, as you see, it's kind of a metaphor for what real romantic relationships are.
Of course.
We had to make a costume. And the fabric just looks beautiful underwater, almost anything you put underwater, but it moves so slowly that whoever's wearing it is going to drown if you put too much on. And we had to sort of minimize how much we could wear before we could actually sort of function as dancers. And so we ended up with this rather chiffon-looking type fabric, so the water was able to pass through it a little bit. And we accessorized with pieces of foam. So it had these stripes of the opposite color. One was a red with blue foam, and one was blue with red foam. And the foam sort of allowed the tails and the fins to float a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fact that we had created these sort of buoyant fins made us a little too buoyant, so we had to put 15-pound sandbags in our bottoms just to sort of stay at this neutral water level. And for 3 days, we were underwater in a 90-degree pool working out this piece, and I think we both lost about 4 pounds doing it. And it just turned out great. The dancing that you're able to do, I don't know if you ever have seen the Howard Schatz photos of the dancers underwater with fabric. Well, we've done living movement that's alive with this fabric, and the way the light catches it, and the way you're able to make it shake and float and quiver underwater is so otherworldly. It just takes dance to a new level, which is always what we're trying to achieve with BodyVox anyway. We're sort of...
Yeah.
I think it's exciting for us to work in a different medium to find the choreography. It makes you choreograph differently. And we would get these emails from the director we work with in, from Los Angeles, and he would say, have you choreographed the underwater duet? And we would say, well, we're kind of working on it. And in fact, it was really hard to work on it because you can't do it in the studio. So finally, we went to this indoor swimming pool and we started choreographing a series of just little, say, 10 or 15 second passages, because you knew that's all you could really do anyway. If once you get underwater and you get set up for the shot and you're carrying 15 pounds of sand, you really can't be down there for 2 minutes because you're just taking a big breath. So we made a series of these little kind of relationship episodes and then strung them together. And it's really quite beautiful. It tells a story of tension, and then finally they become romantic. You know, they're fighting, and then they become romantic. And
if you go to our website, which is bodyvox.com, you can see photos from it, and you can also get a link to see some of our short films. Yeah. Is that right?
Okay.
Bodyvox.com.
Bodyvox.com. Did you say?
.com.
.com.
Yes, I thought, and that's BODYVOX.
Bodyvox.com, of course.
.com, yes.
Okay. Let's go back. I want to go back to the roots of BODYVOX. Mm. And where did you, how old are you, BODYVOX?
Well, we think we started, there's dispute. We kind of started working together in 97, but the company was officially formed in 98. And the company started because Ashley and I had moved back to Oregon, and we did not have a dance company at that point, and we were just doing a series of kind of independent projects. We had both been in Momix and ISO Dance and Palabolas, and we were back just sort of resting. And we got a commission to choreograph Carmina Burana for the Portland Opera. And when we did that, it was a real different way for us to work, working with a huge concept and a huge piece of classic, very well-known piece of music. We created, I think, 23 or 24 episodes.
There may be some people out there, Jamie. Could you give a brief outline of what that
Carmina Burana
is about?
It was written by Carl Orphan. It is music that sets a series of writings from, I think they were monks, and they're very earthy, these writings were. Some of them detail a lot of suffering, some of them detail a lot of debauchery, and basically Carmina is a circle. It starts with the declaration of how life is tragic, and then it goes through and fate rules all, and we're out, you know, we're just like leaves in the wind. And then it goes through a whole series of episodes of romance, sort of cyclical.
Springtime.
Spring, summer, fall, you know, and death, and resurrection, debauchery, romance, religion, and it ends up back, oh, fate, you're the, it's ABA.
Here you come again.
It's just more ABA, Dreck. No, but it's really, it is probably one of the most recognizable
choral pieces.
Yeah, that is in existence. And everyone's heard it, although they may not know.
People love it.
What's unique about
it? It has such drama to it.
Right.
And BODYVOX brings an awful lot of life into it.
We did.
Yes, you did, and you do.
We were fortunate to work with a director who's now the general director, artistic director of the Portland Opera, Chris Mataliano. And what he did is he linked the short opera I Pagliacci, with Carmina and the themes together. And now we're doing a new piece with him, which is Macbeth, which opens in February 4th.
Yeah.
Okay.
At the Keller.
But that's where BODYVOX got its start. And then we, through meeting these dancers through doing this project, we asked a few of them to keep working together. And then we gradually started building more productions. And we've done about one show every year. So we now have, I think, 7 full evening productions. And we tour quite a bit. We're here in Portland. We do 2 shows every year in Portland, and then we tour our work. We just got back from New York and a whole tour of the East Coast, and we have a whole spring lineup of touring. So
okay, yeah. And you have also 2 little boys.
Yes,
yeah, we do.
One is a baby still. Yes, almost.
5 months.
5 months. Mm-hmm. And everybody wants to know how you can do it, but don't tell me that now. we'll hope that you come back another time. And I do thank you so much, you busy, wonderful people, for gracing the... I thank you for gracing the Portland art scene. And the dance art scene. What do you call you? It's modern ballet. What do you call yourselves?
We call it contemporary dance, which
contemporary
is a suitably
dance.
Vague term, I think.
How about the first successful radio dance company?
Perfect.
Yeah. No, okay. we're contemporary.
And we've been talking to Ashley Rowland and Jamie Hampton of Body Vox this morning. And thanks again for coming.
Thanks, Julie.
Thanks, Julie.
And this is Julie Bernard and Art Focus.
Allons dansons. Écoutez et répétez. Well, I love cubism. It's my favorite style. And I see a cubist painting, I just gotta smile. But there's one painter I'm his biggest fan. He's the father of cubism. His name's Cézanne. Cézanne. Cézanne, Cézanne, the father of cubism. Well, some people say that it was Picasso. Other people claim it was de Chirico. Some people think it was Modigliani. But they're all crazy, it was Paul Cézanne. Cézanne, 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 the father of cubism.
When Paul Cézanne sat down to paint a flowery face, he had to solve one problem, three-dimensional space. He said, form is content, he spoke the Gitan. He was right, now he's Paul Cézanne.
Cézanne, 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 the père de cubisme.
Oui, oui.
Hey, Monsieur Kenneth, okay. Show your guitar.
This is KBOO Portland, 90.7 in Portland. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Swahili Inc., specializing in contemporary and traditional African home decor and accessories, and networking with artisans in developing African nations to support economic growth and cultural exchange. Swahili Inc. is located at 128 Northwest 12th Street between Cooch and Davis in Portland, and on the web at swahili-imports.com. Stay tuned now for Democracy Now!